of this presentation is one, to understand the options that are available for treatment, then talk a little bit about the role of topical agents, if at all any, and three, to be able to describe the prevention interventions that are available for the management of tinea infections. So the mainstay of treating tinea capitis infection is actually using systemic antifungals. And the goal of the systemic antifungals is the ability to penetrate the hair shaft, because we say that when the infection occurs, after colonizing the skin, it gets into the hair shaft and then grows with the hair shaft. So any treatment that's given for tinea capitis needs to be able to penetrate the infected hair shaft. So our options that are available are greasefulvin. This is the oldest agent that has ever been. And so any other agent that treats tinea capitis after greasefulvin is described as a newer agent. And so the newer agents include terbinafine, itraconazole, and fluconazole. Now, these new agents are more concentrated in the hair shaft, and they provide fungicidal concentrations after treatment is completed. And this allows treatment durations to be shortened for a bit and gives lower rates of reinfection. Topical agents are not at all effective for the treatment of tinea capitis infection. Okay, so let's talk about greasefulvin, which we have described as the oldest agent for treatment of tinea capitis infection. And it's still the first line in the treatment for tinea capitis and has been used since the 1950s. The dose is 10 to 15 milligrams per kg per day, and it's used for a duration of 6 to 8 weeks. And sometimes this dose can be increased, or the treatment duration can be prolonged for some specific infections. There are cautions and contraindications for greasefulvin use, and these are for pregnant patients, patients who have porphyria, patients with severe liver disease, and in lupus erythematosus. Greasefulvin use actually requires monitoring, especially of liver function. Now, there are reports of symptom resolution with use of greasefulvin, but failure to eradicate with some species of trichophyton. The problem with this is that the spread continues, the spread of the infection continues even after treatment has been completed. When you go to the newer agents, one of the most commonly used one is terbinafine, and the dose depends on the weight. Herein we give doses that are weight banded, where for children who are less than 10 kilograms, you would use 62.5 milligrams per day. For children who are above 20, then you would use 250 milligrams per day. And for in between 10 to 20, then we would use 125 milligrams per day. The treatment duration is shortened to about a month, and you can see this is shorter than greasefulvin's, which is similar to 8 weeks. The efficacy is similar to greasefulvin, and there is a new granule formation that can be sprinkled on food that's approved for use in USA. Now, terbinafine is a little expensive as compared to greasefulvin, and so its use in developing countries is limited because of this. The other thing to note is that it is less effective on microsporum infections, and it can give some side effects, which includes a bit of GI discomfort or rashes. Now, the other group of newer agents is azoles, and here the two commonly used ones are itraconazole and fluconazole. So itraconazole is fungistatic and fungicidal, depending on the tissue concentrations that you have. It has comparable efficacy to greasefulvin and terbinafine. One advantage is that it's available as a suspension. The problem with itraconazole is that there are drug interactions with the azoles that limit its use in patients who are taking multiple medications. Fluconazole is also an alternative, but its use is limited, especially due to cost when you're using it for a long duration of time. The good thing with fluconazole is that it persists in the body for several weeks, even after administration, And one study that compared it to Griselfulvin reported to be comparable in terms of use, its side effects, its compliance, and its efficacy. So it's one of the other agents that can be used other than for cost that limits its use. Now, there are comparisons in different systemic antifungal therapy for tinea capitis in children. And this Cochrane review looked at it to see when you're talking about complete cure, which is both cure of the infection and visible cure, that is both fungal and clinical cure, is the older agent, that is Griselfulvin, comparable to the newer agents, that's terbinafine, itraconazole, and fluconazole. And what this says, what this Cochrane review published in 2016 revealed to us, is that there is low to moderate quality of evidence that suggests that these newer treatments are more efficacious than Griselfulvin, especially when you're treating trichophyton infection. So what this really means for us is that we shouldn't shy off from using Griselfulvin just based on that it's an older agent, thinking that the newer agents are more efficacious as compared to Griselfulvin. The side effect profile might be different. Griselfulvin tends to have a little more side effects, and the treatment duration is longer with Griselfulvin. But when it comes to will you be able to resolve the infection, then the newer agents are comparable to Griselfulvin. Is there any role for the topical agents at all? So yes, the topical agents can be used as adjuncts, and what you use them for is to reduce transmission, especially when this is done in the first 2 weeks of infection. And what you're doing is you're trying to reduce the carriage of variable spores, therefore limiting spread. So you can use them in the first 2 weeks, not as treatment, but as an adjunct to treatment, so as to reduce transmission. They've also been reported to be to cause symptomatic improvement, so you have less itching when the topical agents are used with the systemic agents. And they can be used for asymptomatic carriers who have a low spore loads, especially when you're trying to maintain the infection. They do not eradicate the fungus, and often what you do is apply them to the scalp and the hair for about 5 minutes, and then you rinse, and you will do this 2 to 3 times a week for about 2 to 4 weeks, or until the patient is mycologically cured, and you can be able to check this using the laboratory or using dermoscopy. So what topical agents do you use? You can use shampoos of selenium sulfide at different concentration, ketoconazole at 2%, 1 to 2% zinc pyrithione, and povidone iodine shampoos have been used in low and middle income countries at about 2.5%. Now, there's a topical agent known as squalamine, which is a natural aminosterol that has been isolated from the shark, that has also been used. Now, for the inflammatory types of tinea capitis, which we talked about earlier, with lots of intense itching, scab forming, very distressing, then sometimes prednisone can be used during the first week to alleviate the swelling and the pain. But what you have to remember is the use of prednisone does not affect scarring in any way. Wet compresses can be used when you have large carrions, especially on the head, that have matted hair and scabs and crusts. Then wet compresses can be used to remove those crusts. And sometimes this has warranted inpatient care so that it can be done in hospital frequently and to improve healing. There is no role for surgical drainage, especially when you're thinking about carrions. So let's go to follow-up. After you start the treatment, then you should review this patient in 2 weeks after the first month of treatment to determine the response. And ideally, you're supposed to verify the clearance of the infection with culture. If you get a non-responder, then you increase the dose or you change your medication. And the next thing, if you get a non-responder, is to be able to identify your source, human or animal, and to screen contact and to report to public health authorities. So for primary prevention interventions, so the things we will do to prevent children or groups that are at risk of tinea infections from getting tinea infection is, of course, to have an adequate supply of water for personal washing and hygiene, to encourage them to have regular and thorough bathing with soap and water, paying special attention to moist areas and making sure they are dry. Then we do not share hair brushes, combs, hats, hair accessories, and letting especially children to know that, and having a lot of health education on how to prevent spread, especially in schools, in children's homes, and even for families. Now, after you've already gotten the infection and now you're preventing the spread of this infection to other people, this is what you call the secondary prevention. Then the clothing and the beddings of the infected person should be frequently laundered in hot water to rid them of the fungus. Then you locate and treat the source, especially when you think it's an animal or when it's an asymptomatic individual, and you make sure that you screen all the contacts that you have. So who do we screen? So we screen people at home and we screen people at school. So the contacts at home would be the siblings and the parents, especially the parents. Often with children, we will remember to screen the siblings and forget to screen the parents. And in school, you want to screen the other children who are using the same classroom or the same facilities as the infected child is done. And how we screen is with a careful physical inspection. If you just look with your naked eye and see if you have any scaly patches on the head that are consistent with tinea infection, then you can use a dermoscopy, as we talked about earlier, to try and look for things that may not be very obvious with your eye. Are there any broken hairs? What shape of the hairs do you have? Then when you have fluorescent types of dermatophytes, you can use a wood light, a UV light, with a wood lamp to be able to see, as the hair fluoresces, do you have an infection here? And lastly, you can do a fungal culture. So what do we do with these contacts? So if the contacts are carriers, but they are asymptomatic, that means they have a positive fungal culture, but they have no physical signs of infection, then if they have a low fungal spore load, then you can treat them with an antifungal shampoo. But if they have a high fungal spore load, even if they have no physical signs of infections, then we need to treat them with oral antifungals. Now, if the dermatophyte you're dealing with is a Trichophyton tonsurans, then irrespective of the fungal load, you would treat them with an oral antifungal agent like Griseofulvin, terbinafine, or the azoles. For the next couple of minutes, you're going to talk about the differential diagnosis of tinea capitis. Our objectives are to identify disease entities that have a similar presentation to tinea capitis, and two, to be able to discuss a few distinct features of these conditions that might help us in differentiating them from tinea capitis. So if we were to go through a list of the common conditions that would mimic tinea capitis infection, or that we would be thinking about, we are needing to rule out when we see a patient with tinea capitis, this is the list. And so one of them is alopecia areata, then some forms of atopic dermatitis, then bacterial scalp abscesses or dissecting cellulitis, especially when you're thinking about a carrion, psoriasis, seborrheic dermatitis, and trichotillomania. So we get to go through a couple of images of patients with these conditions and how we might be able to tell the difference. So on the first one, let's look at alopecia areata. And the reason we place these higher on the list of differential diagnoses of tinea capitis is, one, because of the age of presentation. So it has a similar age of presentation to tinea capitis. This is in the preteen area. Alopecia areata is often an autoimmune reaction where the body immune system is producing antibodies against parts of the hair follicles, then leading to falling of the hair follicles and resultant alopecia. So one of the things, and this is a patient with alopecia areata. So one of the things that you notice straight away is that with alopecia areata, you don't have a lot of scaling as you would have with tinea capitis. Then two, we know that tinea capitis is a localized infection, usually of the scalp, while in alopecia areata, it would affect other hairy areas. More significantly, more commonly than it would happen with tinea capitis. Then you would have other systemic symptoms of autoimmunity, like sometimes the nails would be involved. Sometimes you would have patients with other autoimmune diseases like diabetes or celiac disease, type 1 diabetes or celiac disease, and the hereditary component. So when you're wondering, is this tinea capitis, is something going on? Then those are the questions you need to be asking yourself. Is there someone else in the family with a history of something like this? Is there a history of autoimmunity? Do you have other body areas that have this infection, that have a similar presentation? How is the rest? How are the joints? How are the nails? And if you're getting a patient who is having history of symptoms that's a little out of context with what you would expect for tinea capitis, then you would think of alopecia areata. So one other way of making a diagnosis is by dermoscopy, and this is one of the reasons why we would really insist that when you see tinea capitis, you need to go a step further and do a couple of investigations to confirm or rule out your diagnosis. So in alopecia areata, when you do dermoscopy and look at the remaining hairs around the area of alopecia, then what you get is exclamation marks. That's how it's described, and we will get to look at this when we look at the dermoscopy slides, as opposed to tinea capitis, where you get the comma hairs or you get the corkscrew hairs. And another way of really differentiating the two would be doing a biopsy, where you find different things. Biopsy and preps, potassium hydroxide preps, can help you differentiate between tinea capitis and alopecia areata. So the other one would be a dissecting scalp cellulitis, and this is really a difficult one when you have carrion cells and you're wondering, is this a scalp cellulitis or not? And the biggest differentiating factor for this would be pain, the level of pain. So obviously a scalp cellulitis or a scalp abscess is going to be really tender. You're going to have a fever, you're going to have a septic patient with cellulitis, with marked lymphadenopathy, with lots of fever, and tenderness is actually the main thing. And also from history, you want to find out what was going on before. Do you have somebody else at home with a similar presentation or in school? Because we know tinea capitis is one of those disease entities that you're getting from close contact with high attack rates. So often you will get a history of someone else who has had a similar presentation in tinea capitis, which might not necessarily be the case with the dissecting scalp cellulitis. And of course, at this point, it's very important for you to be able to consult and have somebody else who has seen these lesions take a look with you and be able to differentiate out which of the two it might be. Especially also because the management is very different. How you treat a carrion CLC is very different from how you treat a dissecting scalp cellulitis. So a third differential diagnosis of a tinea capitis in scalp infection is actually seborrheic dermatitis. So seborrheic dermatitis is very common. One of the differentiating factors between seborrheic dermatitis and tinea capitis is the age. So often seborrheic dermatitis will not affect children other than brief periods during early infancy when you get cradle cup. Then the presentation of seborrheic dermatitis is later, late teenagehood, mid-20s, not necessarily children. The other thing is the flakiness. So with seborrheic dermatitis, it's what we would commonly call dandruff, and what you get is a lot of flaking of the dead skin is falling off. And you don't get those diffuse areas of alopecia as you would get in tinea capitis. There could be a little confusion with the multiple scaly type of non-inflammatory presentation, but one of the distinct things is the flakiness that you get with seborrheic dermatitis and the age of presentation. So for tinea capitis that you're treating the second, third time, and you're really wondering what's going on here, something else you need to be thinking about is discoid lupus. And with discoid lupus, we know it could be localized or generalized. When it's generalized, then it's very easy to tell because you will have similar lesions in other places of the body. But when it's localized, especially to the scalp area, it can be a bit difficult to differentiated with tinea capitis. One of the distinguishing factors is actually hyperpigmentation. So if you look at previous images of tinea capitis that we have looked at, often it looks hyperpigmented even in dark-skinned patients. Well, in discoid lupus, you can see that this is it's hyperpigmented. It's going towards the dark purplish discoloration. And then, of course, the other systemic symptoms that would be associated with discoid lupus plus the age of presentation. This is usually a presentation of females in their late teens to mid-20s, while we have talked about tinea capitis being a presentation of boys in the preteen areas between ages of 3 years to about 9 years. It can get a little confusing because we know tinea capitis also occurs more in females, and we were talking about the females who are of the reproductive age group and are hanging a lot, spending a lot of time with children or going to the hairdressers and so forth, also being a risk, that's a group that's at risk. But with discoid lupus, you need to be looking further. What's the color of these lesions? Do you have other lesions elsewhere? Do you have other systemic signs? And of course, one of the ways of differentiating the two would be doing a biopsy and going ahead to do immunofluorescence. Another common condition that you need to differentiate from tinea capitis would be psoriasis. And here what you have is almost similar presentation of you have scaly lesions. You have sometimes the age may overlap depending on what you have. And one of the differentiating factors between psoriasis and tinea capitis would be systemic signs. So with psoriasis, sometimes you will have pitting of the nails, you will have lesions that have persisted over a long time. Psoriasis will not oftenly be on the scalp, it would be somewhere else in the body. You could get a positive family history, and of course with a biopsy you will be easily able to identify between tinea capitis and psoriasis, especially if you go a step further with your biopsy and do a mycology culture. So in summary, we've looked at a few of the conditions that would mimic tinea capitis and that we should be having at the back of our minds when we see patients with tinea capitis, especially for children who are coming in the second, the third time with tinea capitis, or tinea capitis infections that are not responding to treatment, or when you see a lesion that doesn't jump out as typical of tinea capitis infection. Then these things should be going through your mind and effort should be made to try and exclude them so that you can make proper diagnosis and treat the patient sufficiently. Thank you very much.